Well, welcome to this latest episode of Logan's Garden Shop podcast. I'm Bryce Lane, your host, and we are in the midst of talking about houseplants. We just finished going through talking about the important environmental factors that we need to consider when we're choosing and using houseplants in our home. And today, we're going to be talking about culture. Now, the word culture comes from the Latin culturae, which means to take care of. And that's what we're really talking about. I think a lot of people who garden really have that nurturing sense about them and are really interested in taking care of plants. And in fact, we tend to go right to the cultural part of taking care of plants rather than the environmental aspects. And sometimes, as I mentioned last time, that can get us in trouble. But today, we're going to actually talk about proper houseplant culture. And knowing that we've already taken into account the environments that we're putting our plants in. But now we've got to build a houseplant, so to speak. Today we're going to talk about containers and the right kinds of pots to put plants in. We're going to talk about media, and the word media is really translated into potting soil, the medium that we put in those pots. We'll talk about water and watering and water relations. And then that one that everybody wants to know about, and that's fertilizing. We'll talk breakdown talking about fertilizing. Hopefully we'll make it simple for you, all right? Then we'll talk about how to keep your houseplants clean, because they do get dirty, and that influences their efficiency. Everybody wants to know about pests. I want to give you a little bit of philosophical perspective on pest management. And last but not least, the one that everybody wants to know about, and that is repotting. How do I go about repotting? When's the best time to repot? And all those things. So that's the agenda for this podcast, and I'm very excited about it. So let's start building that plant. Let's talk about containers. Now, what's so fascinating about plant pots is they've been around for a long time. Ancient Greeks grew plants in containers, and so they're nothing new. But containers always seem to create a lot of questions when it comes to gardening. Let's talk about pots. I'm going to give you the number one consideration for selection of any and all containers for plants that you're going to grow in those containers. For houseplants, but also this goes for plants that you'd put in containers outdoors. All containers that you grow plants in must, and I repeat, must have drainage. They must have drainage holes. I know what you're saying, but I've got some plants in containers that don't have drainage holes, and they're doing just fine. Ladies and gentlemen, when you put a plant in a container filled with soil, the physical properties of that soil in that container change. They're different than the physical properties of the soil out in the garden. And when I talk about physical properties, I'm talking about aeration, how many pores and the size of those pores. I'm talking about water movement, how water moves. Talking about root growth. Talking about all those things that influence the physical aspects of the soil. When you put soil into a container, you've created what we're calling a soil column. Now, can somebody out there tell me, what is the predominant direction of movement of water in a soil column? In a soil that is bound by sides, which way can water move? Vertical. It can only go down. We don't have a lot of lateral movement of water when plants are being grown in containers. Now, compare that to outdoors. We've got significant lateral movement of water, and that influences the way water moves in soils outdoors. That's why I mean the physical properties change. So there must, I repeat, there must be a way for excess water to get out of that container. And the only way that's going to happen is if the container has drainage holes, so that water can percolate through the soil and excess water can exit through the drainage holes. In essence, we're letting gravity have its way on that soil column, all right? Now, many of you may be out there going, well, you know what? My grandmother grows plants in containers, and she's been growing houseplants all her life, and they've all thrived, and none of those pots have drainage holes. Y'all, I am not here to question your grandmother's horticultural prowess. I'm here to tell you what the science says about good houseplant growth. And if your grandmother can grow plants in a container without drainage holes, then I tip my hat to her, and I would say, don't make her change. I learned that a long time ago when I was teaching undergraduates at NC State University, and I was telling them about the importance of drainage holes. And one young man, he went home for fall break. He came back. He lived in the mountains, and he came back, and he said, I told my grandmother that all her pots needed to have drainage holes. And she wanted to know what professor at NC State told her that. And so I told her that you did, and she wanted to know where you came from. So I told her that you came from up north in Massachusetts. And you know what she said? She said, you tell that Yankee to go home where he came from. So I've learned not to question people's ability to grow plants. There's the way they grow them, and then there's the way you should grow them. I'm just telling you about the science of growing plants. If you have that ability to grow a plant in a container filled with soil that doesn't have drainage holes and that plant doesn't die, I'm not going to be the one to tell you you're doing it wrong. But the right way to do it is always pot up your plants in pots with drainage holes. Now, some of you are going, well, I got these beautiful decorative ceramic containers with no drainage hole. Now you're telling me I can't use them? Oh, no, I'm telling you can use them. Just put the plant in a plastic pot with drainage holes. Put a rock or two on the bottom of the decorative pot that has no drainage holes, and then slide that container in. That's called double potting. And so you benefit from having the beautiful ceramic color or the architecture of that pot, but you're still horticulturally giving that plant the soil environment that it needs to grow well. So that's the first question I think I've answered, and that is no more containers without drainage holes. If they don't have drainage holes, then put another container that does in there and give room for water to get away from the roots out of those drainage holes. Paramount. Second, well, should we buy plastic containers, plastic pots, or ceramic pots? Clay versus plastic. We've been talking about clay versus plastic for 100 years. What's the difference? Well, you know, maybe 50 years. I'm not exactly sure when plastic pots came on the forefront. Probably 1950s and 60s when plastic became an everyday word in our culture. But the point is, what's better, plastic or clay? Well, you know, maybe you've heard this argument. Well, if you have a tendency to overwater your plants, then you probably want to use clay pots. Clay pots are porous and water is going to be absorbed into the clay, and that way the soil is going to dry out quicker. And so if you have a tendency to overwater, then use clay pots. Your plants won't die from overwatering. And then, you know, the other side of the coin is, well, if you tend to underwater your plants, then that soil needs to hold on to as much water as it possibly can, so put them in a plastic pot. What I'm going to say right now is not which one's better, but why are we worrying so much about which pot is better based on improper watering? Why don't we focus more on what's the correct way to water? And then it doesn't matter whether we use clay or plastic. I choose pots based on my personal preference, based on maybe the color of the plant or the style of the plant. I like to put succulent plants that are spiny and don't have many leaves like cacti and jade plants. I like to put them in clay pots because they kind of have a rustic look to them. On the other hand, there are lots of plastic pots now that are very clay-esque, faux clay, if you will. They're plastic. They're not gonna break when you drop them on the ground, okay? Clay pots are fantastic, but take a clay pot and drop it, and now you've got a shattered clay pot, or a plastic pot's going to bounce. Okay, plastic pots are lighter. They don't contribute to the weight of that container as much, so for moving our houseplants around, maybe plastic pots for you. Clay pots, oftentimes, they come with clay saucers that also contribute to the weight. So you need to consider those pragmatic things when you're choosing a container. Logan's has some fantastic. Gosh, I'm sitting right here looking through the window where the houseplants are, and I'm looking at some awesome ceramic pots with really cool glazed colors. Not only that, but they come with built-in saucers. Remember, I said if you have a pot, it's got to have drainage hole, and if it's got drainage holes, then the excess water's got to go somewhere. If you're growing your plants inside, then you want to make sure that excess water doesn't flow out all over your coffee table or, you know, the hope chest or wherever you got your plants growing, the kitchen counter. So a saucer is going to be necessary. You've got all kinds of choices for containers, but make sure that they have drainage holes. Now, the next question I'm going to answer for you is, well, do I need how many holes? Should it be one hole, one big hole in the middle, or six holes around the outside? I really don't care. Okay? As long as excess water has a place to get out of the root zone and out of that soil column, then whether it's one hole or six holes, it really doesn't matter. All right. It's just important to get that excess water out of the soil column. So really, that's all I want to say about containers. There are some awesome, awesome containers. Some come with built-in saucers. Some come with saucers that go with the pot that are freestanding. It really comes down to your own personal preference and what you like with those. I'll have one more comment about containers here in a minute when I talk about the soil that we're going to be putting into those containers, but that'll be coming in a second. All right, so that's containers. You've selected a container, and now you've got to put some soil in there. All right, so let's talk about it. Potting soil. I think that if you're going to shop for a medium to put in a container, whether it be houseplant or an outdoor container, I'm going to tell you to stay away from any natural garden soil. When you take soil from your garden or from your landscape and you put it in a container, the physical properties of that soil are going to change significantly. And the most important thing that's going to happen to that soil is it's going to drain poorly because it only has the ability to vertically move water. You might say, well, my garden doesn't. It drains wonderfully. That's right, it does, because it's an outdoor mineral-based soil where the water percolates vertically but also laterally, horizontally. And so the properties of that soil are going to be great outside because it doesn't have any sides, no limitation. But when you put limitation of the sides of a pot on that media, it had better be well-drained. And so potting soil technology in the past 30 years has just done a great job in coming up with the very best medium that we can grow plants in. We call it media, some call it substrate, but if you come into Logan's and you look around, you look for potting soils. Not garden soil, not growing soil, but potting soil. Lots of different types of potting soils. They've been engineered, they've been designed, and the technology for potting soil engineering has really, really progressed well in the past 20 years. You can get some really good potting soil. You say, well, what is really good potting soil? What are the characteristics of a good potting soil? Here are the two things you want to make sure that a potting soil can do. One, good aeration after saturation. Okay, good aeration after saturation. Good aeration, that means lots of airspace. Okay, after saturation. What's saturation? Well, there goes another train, by the way. Saturation has to do with how much water is left in the soil after gravity has pulled excess water through the soil column and out the saucer. Y'all follow me on this? Okay. When you water and you add water to a soil column, gravity is going to pull those water molecules through that soil column. And you know what potting soil is? It's stuff plus space. And the space part of that soil is just as important as the stuff part of that soil. At saturation, after gravity has had its way with that column, in an ideal world, half of the pores should be filled with air and the other half filled with water. Because plant roots grow where there's water and oxygen. And if you don't have oxygen in that soil, you're not going to get much root growth. Because those roots need to absorb oxygen to do the work of root growth. And without that oxygen, I don't care how much you water it, how much you fertilize it, you're not going to get good growth. And so the potting soils that are being manufactured today are being manufactured with soilless materials, peat moss, pine bark, perlite, lots of different components that are organic in nature. They're all organic-based. But they don't include any mineral-based soil particles because mineral-based soil particles in a container impede drainage. We need to improve the porosity of that soil. So a good potting soil has good aeration after saturation, after gravity's had its way. But also, the second characteristic of a good potting soil is that it has to have a good water-holding capacity. You don't want to have to water every day if you have houseplants in your home. You want it to be able to hold water against the forces of gravity so that water can provide the water the plant needs in order to grow and to continue to make sugar through photosynthesis. Plant roots grow where there's water and oxygen, and so we need to make sure that the soil in our pots is a soil that is going to facilitate both water and oxygen when it grows. Now, how does that work? A little scientific, a little soil physics. I don't want to scare you with soil physics, but think about it. Soil equals stuff plus space. The space in potting soil, the space in the soil in your garden is made up of two sizes of pores. One size are called macropores. Those are the big ones. And the micropores are the little ones. We got two pore sizes in any given soil, be it potting soil or garden soil, macro and micropores. Well, how big are they? I don't know the sizes. I don't even care. But here's what I'll tell you. Macropores hold air and are unable to hold water against the forces of gravity. Think about that now. When you water that soil column, water is going to infiltrate all the pores, and then gravity is going to be able to pull water out of those big pores. Micropores are so small that guess what they hold against the force of gravity? Water, right? So if you've got a distribution of macro to micropores that is pretty equal, then after saturation, you're going to have airspace and water space. You've got a perfect medium for root growth. That's the key. And that's why I am so excited about all the different kinds of potting soil. I'm not here to advertise a specific kind. If you come to Logan's, I was just overlooking at the potting soils. They've got some great, great potting soils by some very reputable companies. Miracle-Gro for one, Espoma, and Espoma is a great organically based company that makes some wonderful organic fertilizers, but they also do some great potting soils. As long as that potting soil is in a sealed bag, then you know it's going to be engineered for proper use. Why do I say sealed bag? Because potting soils need to be pasteurized. We need to make sure that all weeds and diseases and insects are clear of those of that soil. And so as a result, they're pasteurized. And they're also uniquely mixed. And like I said, peat moss is one of the basic materials. Pine bark, small horticultural grade pine bark, is also included. Perlite is a volcanic rock that is literally chopped up and heated up till it explodes like popcorn, creates airspace. Those three materials generally tend to be the big three mixes. A lot of now compost is being incorporated, pasteurized compost is being incorporated into those medias. We can trust a reputable potting soil dealership, a company, to create a potting soil that is going to be conducive for houseplant growth, provided we remember macropores, micropores. Okay, these are what we call soilless media. Now, what I like to do, I'm going to just tell you what I like to do. I'm not telling you to do it. You could go and buy a reputable potting soil and use it unadulterated. But because I'm a gardener who likes a little bit more control, I like to use a potting soil and add an amendment to it to improve drainage. I'll add something to make it drain more. I'll add a little more perlite. You can come right here to Logan's and buy a bag of perlite. And you can take perlite and you can mix it with the potting soil. You say, well, my potting soil's got perlite in it. I like to add a little bit more to improve airspace, right? The other thing you can do is you could use some kind of a gravel-based material. One of the things I use is something called permatil. Permatil, it's a great, small, basalt-like rock. It absorbs a little bit of water but creates an airspace and also creates nooks and crannies for roots to grow. I'll either use perlite and permatil, either one, not both, but I'll use either one, and I'll mix it with my potting soil. Of course, you say, what's the recipe? Here's mine. 3 parts potting soil to 1 part perlite. 3 parts potting soil to 1 part permatil. It's by volume, not by weight. Don't make that mistake. You'll end up having to buy 10, 15,000 bags of perlite because perlite is very lightweight. Okay? But it's by volume, 3 to 1. Now, interestingly enough, if I'm growing some cacti or some succulents, I might up that to a 2 to 1 ratio. And that comes from experience. Y'all, I used just unadulterated potting soils. Then I decided I want a little bit more control, which meant I needed to water my plants a little bit more. I added some more drainage materials. That's entirely up to you. But don't feel like you have to add a drainage material because these potting soils have been engineered very well. That's an old habit I had when potting soils didn't drain as well as they do. The other thing is I always like to look for a potting soil where somewhere on the bag it says moisture control. Moisture control potting soils have two things added to them or two things about them that make them just a little bit better. One is they use a finer grade of peat moss. And a finer grade of peat moss results in a little bit better water holding. Okay. The second thing they do is they apply a material called a wetting agent. And a wetting agent is nothing more than a material that helps the soil saturate with moisture faster and more uniformly. Have you ever put some potting soil in a pot, and potted up a plant, and then tried to water it, and the water channeled down the sides, or it displaced the soil, and the soil popped out and over onto the table? Well, that's because the materials in potting soil can be very hydrophobic. They're not interested in absorbing water, right? And a wetting agent makes those materials more hydrophilic, more attractive to water. And if you're not sure about how this works, just remember that just about every day you use a wetting agent on your body when you go in the shower. Okay, soap is a wetting agent. It makes water wetter. It allows water to clean us better because we've added this wetting agent, because that's what soap is. Now, please understand, I don't want you to put soap in your potting soils, because soap is a certain kind of wetting agent that doesn't do the same thing in a potting soil. Leave that up to professionals, and buy those potting soils that often say moisture control, because you'll know that those are the ones that have those components. All right, so there's our potting soil. We've got the pot, we've got drainage holes, we've got the potting soil. Now let's talk about watering. First thing to remember about watering, first and foremost, and y'all, if you listen to this whole podcast and all you remember is what I'm about to tell you about watering, you'll be much better at taking care of your houseplants. Anytime we water our houseplants, no matter what kind of houseplant it is, water to saturate. Water to saturate. And water from the top. I mean, pour the water into the container and let the water percolate down through that soil column. Remember, that soil column is stuff plus space. Right? The macropores, when we water, are filled with carbon dioxide. That's the waste that the plant gives off when it absorbs the oxygen in those pores. So the soil is filled with CO2 in those large pores, right? So when we water from the top, the water percolates down through and it displaces all the sour air, the carbon dioxide air, and it pushes it out through the drainage holes. And it fills those macropores with water. And then when gravity pulls the water out, that creates a vacuum, and those macropores are filled up with fresh air, oxygenated air, which the roots need to grow, right? Not only that, but then the water drains out, and when it percolates through the soil, it pulls out soluble salts. Now, soluble salts build up in a pot, in a houseplant pot. When we fertilize, even when we fertilize with organic materials, soluble salts are the byproducts of when those materials get broken down. And those salts will cause injury over time. So it's really important when we water from the top, we water to saturate because we oxygenate the soil and we're also rinsing that soil of soluble salts. It's really making the soil fresh again. Always water from the top. Always, always water to saturate. Make sure that the saucer fills up with water. Now you say, well, I've got this huge ficus in my sunroom and it's got a pot that's 2 feet across and a saucer. And you just told me that I need to water to saturate so that water fills up in the saucer. And then I'm not supposed to let the water sit there because it'll wick back into the soil and those salts will just go right back in and it'll be detrimental. Bryce, what am I supposed to do with the water? I can't lift the pot up and take the saucer into the bathtub and drain it in the bathtub like I can do with a little plant on my table or in my kitchen where I can lift the plant up, pour the saucer out in the sink, put the plant back down. No, you can't. So what you need to do is go to Bed Bath & Beyond or Home Depot, or not Home Depot, but any place that sells kitchenware and buy a turkey baster. A turkey baster allows you to stick the little nozzle of the turkey baster into the saucer, squeeze that bulb, suck the water up, and then squirt it out in a can or a bucket or even the sink. I have a big, big weeping fig in my sunroom, and when I water it and saturate it, I'll come in with a little bucket, and my turkey baster will take me all of about 3 or 4 minutes to drain that excess water out of the saucer. That way, I'm confident that that water is not wicking back up through the drainage holes and bringing that salt that would be detrimental for root growth back into the plant. Water to saturate, but get rid of the water in the saucer after you've done so. So you say, well, what's the difference between underwatering and overwatering? Let's make sure we understand the difference. Overwatering. Now let's start with underwatering. Underwatering, we don't water to saturate. That's underwatering. Maybe some of you have that tendency where you start to water a plant and worry that maybe you're giving it too much, so you stop. And no water ever comes out the saucer in the bottom. No water ever comes out in the bottom. That's underwatering, and that's very detrimental to plants because their soil's not being oxygenated. We have to water to saturate. You say, yeah, but then if watering to saturate is the proper way to water, then what is overwatering? Overwatering is watering to saturate on a daily basis. It's too frequent watering. Y'all, you can't keep watering to saturate day in and day out or every 2 days for plants that don't need that much water. That can cause root rot. That's just too much. There's something very special about allowing that soil column in the pot to dry out in between watering. When I say dry out, it's not truly, purely dried out, but it is dried to the point where the roots are ready for more water. Research shows that plants grow better when we wait until the soil dries out or almost dries out before we water again. Whether it be a low-light plant from the tropical rainforest or whether it be an arid region plant from the desert. So my mom grows African violets. And she always thought you watered African violets from below. You know, you pour the water into the saucer. Bottom watering is a practice done by a lot of gardeners, and I'm here to tell you that it's not a good thing. At least it's not a good thing to do on a regular basis. When you bottom water, what happens? What happens? That water goes into the saucer. Through capillary action, the water wicks up through the soil. So tell me, what pores are being absorbed? What pores are absorbing water as that water moves against the force of gravity? What pores are being filled with water? The micropores. Tell me, what's happening to the macropores? You know, the ones filled with carbon dioxide, the stale air, the non-oxygenated air? Absolutely nothing. Capillary action can't displace water from the macropores. So when you water from the bottom, you're not oxygenating that soil. You say, well, a lot of plants, I've read that a lot of plants need that. If you're going to bottom water, then once a month you need to top water. And you need to remember to do that. Well, for me, I just say, well, why even worry about bottom watering? There's no real advantage to it. I'm going to water from the top. Unless you talk to my mom, who read in a book once that African violets are going to get lesions on their leaves if you let water droplets fall on the leaves. And so don't top water your African violets because you'll get water spots on your leaves. That's why you bottom water. So I said to my mom, hey, Mom, where are African violets native in the world? She said, what do you mean? I said, where did they originate from? She goes, I don't know. I said, Mom, they're African violets. She said, oh, well, I guess Africa. I said, do you suppose they originated in a place in Africa where it never rained? And she said, no. And I said, well, then how is it the African violets were able to keep the rain off their leaves in their native land without getting leaf spots on them? And she said, well, I don't know. So I went over and I watered her African violets from the top and I spilled water all over the leaves and she got really angry at me. A couple weeks later, she gave me a call. She said, what did you do? And I said, what do you mean? She goes, not one of my African violets has a brown spot on it. What did you do? How did you do that? Well, here's what I know about African violets. They come from a very warm, humid environment where it rains a lot. But guess what the temperature of the raindrops are? They're the same temperature as the air. And when the water that touches the leaves are the same temperature as the ambient air, then there's no chance that the water temperature is going to cause damage. When I water my African violets in the wintertime, I make sure I don't use tap water that's coming from the cold side because water's right about 40 to 45 degrees. Y'all, do you remember from the last podcast? Do you remember chilling injury? Okay, when you water with tap water that came out of the faucet in the wintertime, and the droplets get on the leaves of those African violets, then you're putting a 40 to 45 degree temperature on a leaf that's sensitive to 40 to 45 degrees. What you're doing is causing localized chilling injury. So do you see how you can clean the leaves of your African violets? You can take those babies into the shower and shower with them as long as you are pouring warmer water and not cold water on top of them. So as long as you're using room temperature water or slightly lukewarm, your African violets are going to be happy as all get out. And the last thing I want to say about water, before we talk about when to water, is don't put gravel in the bottom of the container to increase drainage. Do not. I know it's counterintuitive. I know you're thinking, well, wait, I need a layer of gravel in the bottom to increase drainage. Here's the explanation in a nutshell, right? At the bottom of every container without drainage holes, there is a zone where all the pores are filled with water. That's called the saturation zone. Tell me, what doesn't grow in the saturation zone in a soil column? Roots. So wouldn't it behoove you to make sure that saturation zone is very small and far away from the root zone, right? When you put gravel in the bottom of a container, then where is the saturation zone? It happens to be just above the gravel, just above the gravel. So now the saturation zone, if you put 2 inches in a 12-inch pot of gravel and then you put the soil in there, now where's the saturation zone? It's 2 inches above where it was without the gravel. All gravel does is it creates small pores over big pores, and whenever you have that, you create that saturation zone. So the research shows that you need a 12-inch column to maximize good drainage. You say, well, I've got a pot that's two and a half, 3 feet tall. Why can't I put gravel in the bottom? My question is, why would you want to put gravel in the bottom? Put pine cones in the bottom. Make sure you've got 12 to 18 inches of a soil column that will drain well. Put a little landscape fabric over the pine cones or the styrofoam peanuts if you want to use them, and then put your potting soil in. And as long as you have 12 to 18 inches of a vertical soil column, you're going to get good drainage. You say, well, what about pots that are more, that are short and squat and smaller? Well, you solve that problem for me. What are you going to do there? You don't have that long soil column to improve drainage. How are you going to get that saturation zone away from the root zone? Add more drainage material to your potting soil. That's going to increase the pore space. It's going to make the saturation zone smaller, and you'll have more room for roots. So if you understand those principles, do you see how you can manage soil, containers, and watering to the point where those plants are going to benefit? Absolutely. And of course, now, the big one. When do I water my houseplant? Research shows that the best time to water your houseplant is right before it wilts. Right before it wilts. Somebody asked me, well, how do you know when it's going to wilt? And my answer was, and this isn't flippant, I'm just trying to use a little humor here. Watch it wilt once and remember what it looked like just before it did. Right? And that way you'll know. Now, that's kind of a joke, and I wouldn't necessarily put a plant through that whole sequence of wilting in order to remember what it looked like. But y'all, listen, plants are 75 or more percent water. They're going to look a certain way when they're fully hydrated. And slowly but surely, as they begin to become less hydrated, their appearance is going to be different. Soil looks a certain way when it's wet. And as it begins to dry out, its appearance is going to change. If we're going to really embrace this craft of gardening, and if we're really going to be good houseplant growers, then we need to be observant houseplant growers. And we need to pay attention to our plants as they go through their water cycle. So what happens? Well, the soil color changes from darker to lighter as the soil begins to dry out. How does the soil feel? Stick your finger in there. How does it feel? If the top half-inch layer feels a little moist, well, then you know you're in pretty good shape. But if it's bone dry, well, then you know maybe it's time to water. The appearance of the leaves are going to change. When a plant's fully hydrated, the leaves are robust. They're fully turgid, and they're also, they can be somewhat shiny or really glistening, if you will. Where over time, as the water stress begins to increase and water begins to disappear from that soil, those leaves, before they wilt, they're going to become somewhat dull looking. They're going to lose that sheen, right? And then they'll slowly begin to wilt. But a leaf that's under water stress is going to look a lot different than a leaf that's just in a plant that's just been watered. Take all those things, begin to observing your plants, and use that experience to know when to water. Less is better when it comes to houseplants and water. If you're looking at your plant and you're thinking maybe it needs to be watered, here's my recommendation. Wait 2 days and then water it. Wait 2 days and then water it. If you're not sure, wait a couple days, then water it. Remember, watering frequency is a function of when plants are being stimulated to grow, they're going to require more water. When do we need more water? I know I do after I go out and run 3 miles, right? My activity, my behavior is influencing the need I have for water and to be hydrated. Plants that are being stimulated to grow are going to be using more water, right? So we need to be watering our houseplants during those times when plants are being stimulated to grow. You know, like springtime, summer, especially if we put them outside for the summer, and fall. When are plants not being stimulated to grow? Well, starting in December through about middle of the end of February, when the days are the shortest, temperatures are the lowest, even in our homes the temperatures are lower, and the light intensity is decreased, those plants would prefer to rest than for you to water them too much such that their roots rot. So you decrease your frequency. You still use the guides that I spoke about, but you decrease the frequency. Higher light intensity, higher duration, seasonal changes influence water needs. So we water based on the environmental factors that our plants are receiving. So I wouldn't water as much in the winter as I do in the summer, especially if I take my plants outside for the summer. Okay, fertilizing. You think, oh, you could spend an entire podcast on fertilizing. I want to make this simple. Three kinds of fertilizer. One, water-soluble. That's the kind that you scoop with a scoop, put it in water, and it dissolves in water. Not only does it dissolve in water, but the minute you water that soil column, the nutrients are immediately available to the plant. Immediately available to the plant. Do you see some of the advantages of a water-soluble material? You get instant fertilization. Second type, it's called slow release. Any kind of fertilizer that takes time to slowly release its nutrients to the soil is called slow release. Oftentimes we see them as little beads in the soil, little prills. Okay, there's a brand called Osmocote that is pretty much the standard as a slow release fertilizer. Okay, you mix those in or you top dress. Okay, slow release fertilizers slowly release a water soluble material to the soil. And guess what influences the speed that they release it? They've set it up so those little balls are different thicknesses. They have a polymer coating, and they're different thicknesses. So when they get wet and they get warm, they break down. The thicker ones take longer to break down. The thinner ones take less time. So if you have a mixture, what's going to influence how fast that fertilizer is released? Water and temperature. The warmer it is, and the more wet the soil is, the faster that's going to happen. But most slow release have like a 3 to 4 month feeding. So based on what I just said about growing conditions, maybe we don't need to be applying a slow release fertilizer in November, right? Because then the next 3 months it's going to be releasing fertilizer that plant doesn't necessarily need because it's not being stimulated to grow. That's slow release. And the third is organic. And organic just means that it's come from natural organic sources. It means that 100% of the material is organic. Now, what that often translates into is time. A water-soluble material is immediately available. Many organic fertilizers require the slow decay breakdown of bacteria in order for the nutrients in that organic material to be released. And so, therefore, it may take a little bit more time. Now, there's some great products out there. Espoma makes a wonderful fish-based fertilizer that has a water-soluble component to that organic source, and you can use those. The only concern I have about fish-based fertilizers, they're wonderful organic fertilizers, and plants really respond positively to them, is that they can be a little bit smelly. And if you're going to use them at certain times of the year and you don't have good ventilation, I could always tell when I came home from school as a kid when my mom used fish emulsion fertilizer on our houseplants, because I'd walk in the door, and then I'd turn around and walk right back out, because it took about, half a day to a day for that fish smell to get out of, you know, to dissipate from the plants. But if we think about the three types, we take control over that, remembering that fertilizing doesn't have to be the number one activity of taking care of our plants. Remember that environmental factor? So here's my recommendation for fertilizing. If you haven't incorporated it into the potting soil, and believe it or not, there are some potting soil companies that will add a slow-release fertilizer into the potting soil. That's perfectly fine, but you better be aware of it so you can curtail your fertilizing above and beyond that. Secondly, let's talk about frequency. Fertilizing frequency. When is the best time to fertilize? All right, this is my recommendation. In the spring, fertilize once a month. Say which type, whichever type you'd like to use. In the summer, fertilize once every 2 weeks. Especially if you've put your plants outside for the summer. And when you take your plants from the inside to the outside, there's one thing to remember. One, do it after the chance of frost has completely gone away. Two, take them outside and put them in the shadiest spot you can possibly put them, even if they're highlight plants. They're going to need a little bit of time to acclimate. And three, slowly move them into their required light zone after they've sat in full shade for about a week. Believe it or not, full shade outside is way brighter than low light inside. And so we need to adjust them. Can I ever put a jade plant in full sun? Sure. But when you take it outside, you need to take 2 or 3 weeks to slowly increase the light intensity. Because if you take that plant, that jade plant, and you put it outside in full sun, it's going to get sunburned. Those leaves are going to fry because those leaves are not used to that. It's no different than sunburn. They're not used to that high light intensity. So we need to acclimate the plant. So if you put it outside for the summertime, I'd fertilize once every couple weeks, especially if you're having a lot of rainfall. Think about the nutrition that's leaching out through that soil column. All right. And I would tend to steer more toward organic fertilizers if I'm putting my plants outside for the summer, because the fertility is not being released all at once. And then if it rains, it drains out. Then in the fall, once a month. In the wintertime, guess how much I'm fertilizing? Big fat zero. Right? So as soon as November hits, I'm not fertilizing my houseplants anymore. And I'm not going to fertilize them until the end of February, beginning of March. Let's not make fertilizing too complicated. Let's make it simple, understand where it fits in the culture and the environment of growing houseplants. Couple more things, and then I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to devote an entire podcast to pest management. So I'm going to withhold my comments on pest management, because the basics for pest management are entirely the same for all plants. And that's a well worthwhile podcast to have, and that's devote one entirely to pests, because you gardeners out there, I know how much pests bother you. Shoot, they bother me too. So two more things when it comes to houseplants. One, cleaning. That's easy. We need to clean our houseplants. How often? Once a month. Did you know a layer of dust on leaves can decrease light absorption in a houseplant by 20%? Y'all, you need to clean your houseplants. Well, how am I going to do that? Two methods. One, take a damp cloth, wipe off all the leaves. That's called the damp cloth method, right? I know you've got a lot of plants and a lot of leaves. You might change the name of the damp cloth method to something else. Just take the P off damp, and that's the method you'd be using. What I like to do is I call it bath time. I take my plants, I put them in the tub, I take the shower head off the nozzle or off the spigot, and I rinse them. You say, well, I don't have a nozzle. I can, well, then put your plants in the shower and turn the shower on. Put your plants in the sink in the kitchen and pull out the spritzer and spray those plants. You do that once a month. You're going to keep those leaves clean. The pores on the bottom of the leaves are going to be able to exchange air and carbon dioxide and water. And you're also going to decrease dust on those leaves. So those are the two main. Don't use leaf shine. Leaf shine is a product that is a fat-based product. It'll clog the pores of the leaf. Oh, the leaves will look awesome, but they're not going to function as well as they could have. All right, last thing, repotting. You said, Bryce, you could have devoted an entire podcast to repotting. Nope, repotting can be just easy. First of all, here's my declaration. Repotting is not heart surgery. Okay, we don't have to put the plant on a heart-lung machine when we're taking it out of the pot. Plants are not going to die because we took our time repotting. So there's no excuse when we repot for a plant to end up crooked in the pot. I know my mom used to repot plants, and she was like, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. And I would help her, and the plant would be crooked in the pot. And I'd say, Mom, it's crooked in the pot. Can we move it in the middle? She'd say, no, I don't want to bother the plant. Move it. It's not heart surgery. First thing, how often do our plants need to be repotted? Well, it depends on whether they're surviving or whether they're thriving. If they're thriving, we might need to repot them more frequently than they're surviving. We need to check, pull the plant out of the pot and look at the root system. If the roots have grown all the way to the outside, we call that pot bound. And if the roots have started to grow around the pot, then we need to consider repotting that. 1 to 3 years on average, depending on growth. We need to be the judge of that. Well, how big a pot should I repot it in? Well, that's up to you. But most research indicates that if you're going to repot into a larger size, go one size larger. So if it's in a 6-inch, move to an 8-inch. If it's in a 4-inch, move to a 6-inch. Move to the next size up. But who says you have to move up? Why not just repot right back into the same size pot? Then you don't have to buy a new pot. Think about it. If I have a weeping fig and it grows into a tree in my sunroom, and every time I repot it, which is every year because it grows so much, because it's in good light, I increase by a size. At one point after 20 years, and I've had that plant for 25 years, you do the math. How big should the pot be? It's not sustainable. Not only that, but when I repot my ficus, it comes out of the pot that it's been in for the past 3 years. I remove all the soil. Then I take my pruners and I cut a third to a half of the roots off that root system. Don't worry, you're not going to hurt the plant. I put fresh soil into the pot that it was in. Oh, by the way, I cleaned that pot with 4 parts water, 1 part Clorox, just to clean it up. Soap and water works just as well. Then I put the new potting soil back in, and that plant goes back in the same pot. Well, how long could you do that? Indefinitely. The plant thrives. Plant thrives. When's the best time to repot? Well, when do you have time to repot? No, Bryce. When's the best time to repot? Well, I like to repot my plants, especially my house plants that are coming in from the summer, right now. Clean off I wash the plants off, make sure they have no critters on them. I take them out of the pot. I wash all the old soil off. I prune the roots. I put new soil in the pot. I put them back in the pot, and inside they go. Now's a great time to repot, in the fall. But that doesn't mean you can't repot in February and March when the light intensity is starting to increase and light duration's increasing and that plant's being stimulated to grow. How cool is that? Well, Bryce, do I always have to prune the roots when I repot? You don't always have to, but it's not a bad practice. But I'm not going to repot my plant until the roots are all the way to the outside of the pot, if not matted or pot-bound. Plants actually grow better when their root volume is full than when the root volume is less. So that's the skinny on repotting. Not a big deal. It's not rocket science. It's not heart surgery. We can take our time. We can practice those basic principles. Understand that when you prune roots, you're not hurting the plant. You're actually stimulating root growth. And think about it. With new potting soil, you're ready to go. Folks, you're ready. I know you're ready to start growing more houseplants. You understand how to evaluate the environment. You know how light, temperature, relative humidity influences plant growth. That's going to make you better plant selectors. And now you know culture. You can choose the right containers, the right potting soil, the right way to water and water dynamics, fertilizer, and how that you can make that simple. You can keep your plants clean and repot them on a regular basis. And my guess is, your houseplants are going to be growing better than you've ever had them grow before. And if you're not sure, here's the good thing. You come right down to Logan's Garden Shop and you can ask for help. The professionals here that help people select plants, choose pots and potting soil, know all these things, and they can help you make the best choices for you to grow houseplants in your own home, in your apartment, in your condo, just about any indoor space where you've got enough light. So that's what I've got to say about culture and houseplants. I hope that these two podcasts will put you in a position to, one, go out and try growing some houseplants if you've never done it before, or two, that you've got to have a resurgence of interest in growing houseplants in your own home. Come on down, get some plants, and enjoy the benefits that come from growing plants indoors. So until next time, you know where I'll be looking for you. I'll be looking for you in the garden, or even right down here at Logan's Garden Shop. Stay tuned for the next podcast.